Welcome back. In the midst of the men of 1916 was the woman of 1916, Countess Markievicz, also known as Constance Gore Booth. Although dozens of women were involved in the 1916 Rising in one capacity or another, the image of the Countess in her uniform dominates our awareness of the female contribution to that pivotal event. And we're getting lots of reaction on text already to the question about whether she is or is not an icon, an overrated icon. She was the first woman elected also to the House of Commons and was an active participant in the War of Independence as the country's first female government minister. The second, I do believe, I'm sure I'll be corrected on this one, but I actually think it was Maura Geoghegan Quinn in 1979, so it took over 60 years for the next female member of government. But how much do people actually know about the woman behind the myth? Owen Sweeney took her to the streets to find out.
Countess Markievicz, no, name would not ring a bell.
She was the War of Independence, I suppose, so other than that, I think maybe the Abbey Theatre as well, I'm not too sure.
1916,
Yes, I do. Was her husband a Polish count of that? And was she the first woman to be elected to the British Parliament, though she didn't take her seat?
She was indeed.
And a formidable woman.
She had something to do with the Irish independence. And that's all I know.
She used to wear a gun under a big coat, you know, when she was in the Dáil.
I'd recognise the name, but that's as far as you go.
Countess Markievicz. She was, I think she was the first woman in politics.
We swim over where she's, her statue is over at Tower Street.
Yeah.
She was a suffragette or something, wasn't she?
No, she was the first woman in the government.
And she wasn't from a poor family either. She was from a rich family.
Not a clue.
She came from Sligo, came from that end of the country myself, you know. So I know a lot about Countess Markievicz. A revolutionary, sure enough, yeah, yeah.
There was food parcels being given out in Liberty Hall, but you had to have a ticket. So this little boy, his mum sent him to collect it with the ticket. They were very poor, and he lost the ticket. And he was really upset. He couldn't go home. They were starving. He had no food. She just saw him, asked him what was wrong with him, took him in and fixed him up with the food parcel. That's one good thing.
W.B. Yeats, I think she was having a little fling with.
Probably a lot less than I should know.
I'm going to read up on her now when I go home.
Right, some interesting misapprehensions there, but before we investigate whether Constance Markievicz is an overrated icon of Irish history, we probably need to sketch out her story a little bit. I'm joined by historian Shane McComosh of Glasnevin Cemetery, where the Countess is buried, and Anne Matthews, author of Renegades, Irish Republican Women, 1900 to 1922. Shane, just give us a little bit of background. Who was Constance Gore Booth, a.k.a. Countess Markievicz?
Well, she was born in 1868. Anglo-Irish family, very rich up there in Lissadel, presented to the Queen in court, in open court, when she was 16. Came back to Ireland, married a Polish count, that's where the Countess comes from, came back to Ireland, got involved with the cause of Irish labour and Irish national identity, set up Nafina Boy Scouts, was out in the lockout helping feeding people in the kitchens of Liberty Hall, and ultimately took part in the 1916 Rising, where she was second in command in Stephen's Green Garrison, sentenced to death, not executed and imprisoned, and like you said at your opening piece, fought hand and foot through the War of Independence and the Civil War, and died relatively young in 1927.
Okay, some of the comments that have come in already. She paved a way for women when every effort was being made to keep them hidden away in domestic settings. You have to hand it to her. She had real class. She deserves to be remembered for siding with the oppressed against the oppressor, as represented by her own class, whereas somebody else says she shot dead an unarmed RIC man at point blank range in St. Stephen's Green. Shame on her. That's a comment from John. A number of other comments coming in. I'll bring those to you in a while. And you don't have an awful lot of time for her, but you have to give her, surely, full marks for style. Apparently she intended her first meeting of Maud Gonne's organisation, Inní na hÉireann, and the Daughters of Ireland, wearing a satin ball gown and a diamond tiara, because she'd just come from a function in Dublin Castle.
Well, can I just sidetrack this slightly? The icon, the created icon, is Constance Markievicz, the real woman, not the icon, is Countess the Markievicz. And she always signed herself the Markievicz. It was 1908 when she was brought along by Helena Maloney to that meeting. Many stories have been told about that meeting, and there is the possibility, because Helena was an actress in the company, the Theatre of Ireland, as was the Countess, because the Countess and her husband lived in relative penury. And there is the strong possibility that she was wearing her gown and her tiara because it had been part of her clothing in the play.
Right, okay, so it wasn't actually hers.
No,
okay.
But they weren't diamonds.
She appears to have done some, forgetting altogether her involvement with Irish nationalism, she appears to have done some good work for the suffrage movement in Britain in the early 1900s. For example, she helped to prevent Winston Churchill from winning a seat in the Manchester North West by-election.
Yep. Well, she was involved in the suffragist movement. Now, she put it on the side for the cause of Irish independence. And that's what a lot of women suffragettes did at the time. They said that the question of the franchisement of women will be put. We will free Ireland first. There's no point in having the vote under a United Kingdom. So she sidestepped. But then in England, the suffragettes did the same thing about World War One, and they said, we'll fight World War One, and then we'll come back to the fight for equal. So, yes, she was a suffragette. The first woman elected in a parliament. Like, this is remarkable. This is a woman running on her own, single candidate woman, and she gets elected. And she gets elected to the first all. And then she gets elected again, a third and fourth time. The only time, in fact, she loses an election is during the Civil War, when she's on an anti-treaty ticket. Mm. And even then it went to the fifth count. So a woman just standing for elections is revolutionary in itself. Getting elected is wonderful. And then having got her elected, they weren't just happy enough to have her as a paper candidate that she'd sit at the back somewhere. They actually made her a government minister. So her contemporaries looked at her as somebody of huge value.
Did she serve a useful purpose in founding Fianna Éireann, which was a sort of an Irish nationalist scouting / revolutionary movement?
Yes.
You think she did?
Well, Padraig Pearse said, without na Fianna, there'd be no 1916. Because these were the young boys, and a lot of the leaders of the 16 Rising had come through the ranks of na Fianna. So if Padraig Pearse says, without na Fianna, no 1916, then I'd believe him.
Anne, what do you
think? Can I come back to the suffrage issue first?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay.
Her sister, Eva Gore Booth, was heavily involved in the suffrage movement for working class women in Manchester and Salford, and had made her living and was making a living and living in Manchester. And she was the more intelligent of the two sisters. She was a writer and a poet. And Constance, who was still, who was before she was married, turned up in Manchester to these rallies to help and encourage her sister at the meetings, at the suffrage meetings. She did not organise the meetings. She showed up to make a play, to make a show as the pseudo countess, and people went with it. But it was her sister who was the suffragette, not she.
OK, in relation to Fianna Éireann, are you conceding Shane's point that if Padraig Pearse says no Fianna Éireann, no 1916, therefore she did something good, she served a useful purpose?
Well, I don't know when Padraig Pearse said that, because he was executed shortly after 1916. But I think her significance in Fianna Éireann is that she was allowed to be involved. The boys apparently didn't want her, but they allowed her to be involved because she was paying the rent on the room. But the other interesting thing about na Fianna was, in Dublin they didn't allow girls in, and in Belfast they did. And the fact that they didn't allow the girls in Dublin was down to the Countess.
Okay, but she was paying for the room, so at least she was offering financial support.
We are told she was paying the rent for the room. Yeah.
Okay, let's talk about her work during the 1913 lockout. Did she feed the families of strikers, Shane, or was she just someone who liked to give the impression that she was down with the striking classes, as it
well were? No, she definitely worked in the kitchens. And Helena Maloney wrote a letter to Sean O'Whelan, because Sean O'Whelan had written a book that was kind of contemptuous of Markovitch, and she said she would do any task, no matter how big or small, she would go into it, and she didn't do it for attention. Where that line of argument comes from is Sean O'Casey. Sean O'Casey, probably one of the bitterest writers out there, writes a beautiful biography.
He loved Markovitch.
He was a misogynist, and he didn't like Markovitch at all. And he tried to get her thrown out of the Irish Citizen Army. When people didn't vote the way Sean wanted them to do, they took up their... Sean took up his little ball of socialism and said, I'm not playing with you anymore, and left the Irish Citizen Army because he didn't win the election. And ever since
then,
he
had his 95... to work with as she was to work
well,
with.
I mean, he didn't resign when she lost the vote. Which is exactly what O'Casey did. And then when he was writing his biography, he gets the knife out for her and says she's a Catherine Wheel of irresponsibility and she's always looking to the cameras. But for years, this woman worked amongst the Dublin poor, and they're not sold out that easily with somebody who's just a publicity hunter. Her contemporaries all speak hugely higher. If you go to the Bureau, a military bureau, and look through the witness statements, none of them are saying Countess Markovitch was all about ego image. They all have an awful lot of time for her, including the boys in the Nafina, who clearly loved her as a leader.
Anecdotally, and she apparently paid for the food that was provided by her in the lockout and sold her jewellery to do so. I mean, that's what I've read. I'm not sure whether it's true or whether it's a myth. So, you know, she did, again, it would appear, serve a useful function in 1913 in the lockout.
The British TUC sent money to Dublin for food chips. They gave £300 to the Countess and some ladies to have a soup kitchen in Liberty Hall, and they bought a cauldron with the £300. They were given food from the food chips to provide soup, to cook soup in it, and the soup kitchen lasted all of 3 weeks and it was closed down. For the other 4 months of the lockout, the women and children who were fed, they were fed by a committee run by Sean O'Casey, Patrick Lennon, Díola Larkin and Grace Nail. And they fed thousands of children and pregnant and nursing women for the other 4 months of the lockout. The Countess was involved all of 3 weeks, and Connolly closed it down because it was chaotic.
OK. Did she become a motive force, Shane, in the Irish Citizens Army, or was she just a peripheral figure in the ICA?
Well, I think she was a motive force, but she was remarkable as well because she was involved with the Volunteers and the Citizen Army at the same time. Now, those are two very antagonistic bodies towards each other when they formed in 1913, because they saw they would take memberships from each other. And here was somebody that was able to stand a foot in each camp and be accepted by each camp. She foresaw 1916 of the two of those armies coming together and fighting under the one banner when nobody else could. In fact, you know, some people went around saying, hold on to your guns, boys, we're going to have to be fighting the Volunteers next. She stood with both sides. So she breached the gap before anyone did. Remarkable.
Anne?
Countess Markovitch's number in the army was 55. She had no rank whatsoever. She was the only woman in the Citizen Army. She was not a member of the Irish Volunteers at any point, because we know the Irish Volunteers did not allow women membership, not even making an exception for the Countess, which the Citizen Army did. But she was a rank and file member, given a title on the eve of the rebellion.
OK, well, certainly, presumably then, that means that she was not involved. If she was that peripheral, she wouldn't have been involved in the disastrous decision to dig trenches in Stephen's Green, thus exposing the command, Michael Mallon's command, to sniper shooting from the many tall buildings around the Green. So she's exonerated from that, because that's one of the things that, one of the many things that she's been blamed for.
OK, the trenches in the Green. Countess Markovitch was appointed chauffeur to Dr. Kathleen Lynn, who was the medical officer for the Rebel Army. She abandoned Kathleen Lynn at City Hall. By the time she arrived in Stephen's Green, the rebels had taken the Green and they were digging the trenches. The trenches had nothing to do with the Countess. Now, the Countess says she was made second in command. There is no witness to that.
Except Christopher Michael Poole. Mallon.
Christopher Poole was appointed second in command. When Michael Mallon said what he said, he was trying to save his own life.
Well,
and that makes sense. But she was not second in command because she knew nothing about military
strategy.
Well,
he was the only leader of the Rising that decided to try and save his own life. I don't remember Pierce trying to blame somebody else for the Rising. Seamus Robinson, in his Starry Plough, says that she was second in command. The men in Stephen's Green and the Whitman statements all say Countess Markovitch was second in command. So this thing that only she knew about it and she made herself doesn't add up. Why were they following her? She was going around and she was putting stations and first aids and whatnot. She directed the withdrawal into the College of Surgeons. Why would they listen to this person who just invented that title for themselves? But most damning of all, Malin gets up and says, it wasn't my idea, it was all Markovic. She was in charge in Stephen's Green in 1916. If Markovic had done that the other way around, we'd be here calling her a traitor, and we'd be... This is measuring a woman by different standards than we measure our men.
OK, well, we'll come back to that, because we don't know precisely what she did say at her own court-martial, and that is also an object.
The witness statements.
Yeah.
The witness statements are written 30 to 35 years after the event. In hindsight, and due to the iconography already existing, people came to believe she was second in command. In Stephen's Green, she was not responsible for the first aid. Madeleine French Mullen was responsible for first aid. And the women of the Citizen Army were responsible for getting the food. Markovitz was there and not responsible to anybody or for anybody. And all of this thing about she was second in command comes retrospectively.
OK, and we also have a text from Owen who says, according to Tom Mallon in 1960, Markovic said to his brother before the surrender that it was more important for him to survive rather than herself for the sake of his family, who had only him for support. What about the issue then of the shooting of the RIC constable? What was it? Lahiff, was that his name?
Yeah, Lahiff. Now I find myself agreeing with Anne. The statements that were made 30 years later... And Anne will have read them and I read them. They're all over the place. People get days wrong, they get dates wrong, they get people's names wrong. They've learned stories over the years that aren't quite as true. But if you read enough of them, you can weave a tapestry of truth from them. And the only, to my knowledge, accusation of her shooting the policeman is from a nurse that was at a hospital on Harcourt Street, and she said she saw Countess Markovic shoot a policeman point blank in the face. It's not true. The post-mortem on the police had him wounded three times, twice in the legs, one in the lung, from a volley of fire, they believe. Nobody in the witness statement says that Markovic shot a policeman. Not one person that was there. The only one that's coming from is this nurse who handed in pages of her diary, not her diary completely, just pages of it, to the British authorities. So I reckon her sympathies lay somewhere else.
And just because of the number of misapprehensions there are about Constance Markovic, somebody wrote to us during the week and says, I understand she shot a poor nurse pushing a pram in Stephen's Green. Yeah, the nurse was the witness, or claims to have been the witness, and you dispute that.
Okay. Constable Michael Lahiff. There is no post-mortem report, but there is a death certificate, and it says very clearly he was shot by one bullet entering his lung and come out to his left arm. The witness who saw him was Nurse Geraldine Fitzgerald. She was a district nurse. She was at the St. Patrick's nurse's home beside the Russell Hotel, directly facing the gate, where she saw her say, I got him, I got him. And it was she who talked, in her journal, wrote what she saw that day. And the reason her statement can be taken very seriously is because she also goes on to describe what she saw some of the younger women doing, which is actually in R.M. Fox's statement. And her statement is a very, very sound and solid statement.
But where is her statement, Anne?
It's in the British Archives. It's in the archives in London. Yes, and I have cited it in my book, Renegades. It's there.
It's a copy of it. It's not the original diary. It's two pages from it.
In 1917, Geraldine Fitzgerald got a job in Limerick.
Yeah.
She went home to Roscrea to her mother, was packing her stuff, and showed her mother her journal. And her mother encouraged her to bring the journal to the police station. And they typed up word for word what was in her journal.
Yeah. But if you find a document in archives that's a type-up of an original document, but you don't see the original, then you wonder about, you know, the authorship.
Well, I have. Have you read the original document?
I have read.
It's in London. It's very easy to get.
It's the transcript in Q. I have read it. It's a transcript of the diary.
Yeah.
It's not the diary.
It's still a transcript.
Yeah,
but it's a transcript.
But I can add or subtract.
Well,
or
I mean, if it was in a court of law, you would
Miles's
say there's a transcript would not
and
actually
say I found
qualify.
This on page 7 and 8.
She wasn't going to give them over her diary.
Why not?
They transcribed her diary.
Why not give her the diary?
I'm going to write a play about this.
We come to her court martial.
Yeah.
Did she insist on being shot, which is her version of events, or did she plead, you can't shoot me, I'm a woman, which is another version that was recorded at the time? Shane.
You see, again, Markovic frightened the British. And why did she frighten the British? Because she was a woman. She was of upper class. She couldn't be dismissed really easily. And she couldn't be just put down down as a lunatic or whatnot. So they start this, sullying her name. And part of this was straight away, you know, she shot a policeman, she shot a nurse, she shot five soldiers. She was lunatic, she was crazy, putting her into this position. And then her court martial, oh, she broke down and cried and screamed for her life, or she begged them, you know. I wouldn't believe any of the propaganda that came out after the rising of how people responded. And that sometimes worked to the rebels' favour.
That particular statement, "you can't shoot me, I'm a woman,"
made them all out to be saints,
comes from William Wiley, who went on to become a very respected judge during the term of the Irish Free State.
Yes, absolutely.
And there is a second prosecutor.
Get things wrong.
There's a second prosecutor says the same thing. But before the court martials took place, Maxwell decided he was not going to
this
execute
a woman. This
is General
Sir John Maxwell, who was the military governor.
Yes, yeah. I'm sorry, yes. And a decision was taken, there was no begging involved, a decision was taken that no woman would be executed. The year before, an English nurse had been executed by the Germans in Europe.
And they shot Mata Hari.
No, excuse me.
You know, they shoot women.
The propaganda, the anti-German propaganda, because they killed this British nurse, was absolutely powerful. And the British were not going to put themselves in that position. That's my take on it. But the decision was taken before the court martials ever took place that no woman would be executed. That's it.
But she didn't know that.
Yeah, that's why she cried. She thought they were going to kill her.
No,
she cried in song. Why she cried.
But like, one minute we have Malin able to fight whatever way he can to get out of the death.
Yeah.
And now Markovic cries and she's the weaker sex. And this is
No. Playing this sex game is... I don't go
game.
With playing
it's
no,
not
it
a
is,
game.
It
and
is,
any
no.
woman out there
no,
will know
no,
that
no,
she's
no.
been judged by a different set
no,
of standards.
No, she didn't know what Malin did.
Any man. Whoever accuses Pierce of loving the spotlight, or Tom Clark as self-appointing himself, you know, we don't do this with anybody else.
Exactly.
But when it comes along to Markovic,
exactly.
It's
the iconography is different.
Yep, because it's easier to displace a woman from these positions than a man. And that's what the British were doing.
What's really interesting about that iconography? It's all written by women, apart from Ó Fhéilán.
Okay, well, let's talk about some of the women who have written about Countess Markievicz, because she was certainly not popular. I think you'd have to agree, Shane, with some of the other female prisoners in Mountjoy in the aftermath of the 1916 Rising. Tom Clark's wife, Kathleen, for example, felt that she set herself above the other prisoners.
Yeah, but... You know, prison does strange things to people. And I know personal experience that, you know, people go into prison, odd things happen to them. It magnifies different traits in them. My dad said once that it magnifies the good parts of you and it also magnifies the bad parts of you as well. So, yeah, was Markovic perfect? Absolutely not. Did she have faults? Absolutely. But is she a wonderful icon for Irish history, for womankind, for revolution? Yes, absolutely. So take it all, you know, not just the bad parts, not just the good parts, the whole lot. And if you look at the legacy of her, it's fantastic. Markovic herself, writing to her sister Eva just before she died, she said, "My enemies will make me out to be a monster, my friends into a martyr. I am neither. I did very little." Now, that to me is a wonderful person and somebody definitely worthy of our respect.
Well, Shane, when the Civil War began, and then in September 1922, they decided that they would have to intern women because they realised the women were every bit as problematic as the men. And within a week of that announcement, she left Ireland and she didn't come back until it was all over.
Well, would you blame her if she was going to be
end
up in jail?
No, but earlier on. Yes, no, that's fine. But don't tell me she stood in and she stood there and she led the women to the war.
Wasn't
she
the
didn't.
Only person who ever left Ireland during
no,
the Civil
but
War.
No, my point
hundreds
is
hundreds left afterwards.
My point
and
is
didn't come back till De Valera came back.
No, my point is it's been used as she's been the leader. She was there. She wasn't.
She was there in 1909 when the Na Fianna was founded. She was there in 1913 during the lockout. She was there in 1915 during O'Donovan Ross's funeral. She was there in 1916 during the Easter Rising for 5 days in Stephen's Green. She was imprisoned afterwards how long was she sentenced to? When they took away the death sentence, how long was she sentenced to?
Penal servitude, but
penal
she did.
Servitude.
Penal servitude hanging over her. Yeah.
You know, again, all of these things are weights on the psyche. She was here for the War of Independence. And then during the Civil War, she decides to go to Scotland. And what? She ran away? That's the legacy.
She did run away, yes. And during the War of Independence was paid £500 a year. Yeah.
Okay, I made the point at the beginning that she was a cabinet minister. I made the point that, as far as I'm aware, the next government minister, well, not even a cabinet minister, because I think at the time in 1979 she was only a junior minister, was Maura Gaydon Quinn. So it took that length of time for a woman to occupy any kind of major governmental role. You feel, Anne, that the intransigence of Republican women like Constance Markievicz, which made it more difficult for Irish women to succeed in politics after the revolutionary period.
You see, a leader to me, a leader is somebody who brings people along, who encourages people to take part. Markievicz was never a leader. She was only the only female member of the Citizen Army, and she never encouraged women to be a member of the Citizen Army. Women were auxiliaries of the Citizen Army, just like Cumann na mBan were to the Irish Volunteers. She never encouraged it. To the rise of the second Sinn Féin, she was not involved when the other women fought to have a place on the executive, on the committee, or even a serious membership of the organisation. Markievicz stood back and everyone else did the work. She was not a leader. She was somebody who was there. Her pseudo-countess aristocracy gave her image. The image was that this woman was the leader of women. But on the ground, she was not leading anybody. And while she was involved in all of those things, there were many women whose names we don't know who are equally involved.
Okay.
Absolutely no argument there. And a great example would be that we're going to name a bridge over Dublin River Liffey, Rosie Hackett Bridge. Now, Rosie Hackett hasn't left behind a pantheon of left thinking. She isn't a leader of women. She isn't, you know, she's just an ordinary person who was rank and file member. And that's, Anne's absolutely right. Those are just as important to remember. And the Kathleen Lynns and all of the Sheila Grennans and Nurse O'Farrells, all of these are worthy of remembering. But that doesn't mean we have to throw out Markievicz to make room for them. We just need to throw out some of the men
a
little bit.
Okay, straightforward question, and this should not involve an argument. How did the Countess die and at what age? 1927, wasn't it?
1927, and it was...
She would only have been about 59.
No, she died from peritonitis.
Oh, peritonitis.
Yeah, she had her appendix removed and she developed peritonitis.
Because there's even a dispute about the facts of her death. Either she died of TB contracted while doing charity work, which is one story, or she died of complications.
Get the death cert.
You know, the sad thing, Miles, is she was coming up to Glasnevin to be buried on a Sunday. And trade union rule said that graves couldn't be dug on a Sunday. It was a rule that they'd fought for in 1911. And when they came up, there was no grave dug for her. And they said, right, OK. So they said, put her in a vault. We'll dig her a grave tomorrow. And they put her in a vault in the O'Connell Circle, and the next day they dug the grave. So this Minister for Labour, who had fought for trade union rights, lived with them right to the end.
Okay, just a few of the...
Can I just say one thing?
Briefly, yeah.
Two women to me who were the leaders, Dr. Kathleen Lynn and Jenny Wise Power. Mm. And we don't hear enough about either of those two women.
Yep.
Oh, well, I'm sure during the decade of commemoration we will hear a lot more. According to Tom Allen, says Owen, she wanted to execute Lawrence Kettle. Lawrence Kettle would have been a Redmondite or a moderate nationalist, but Mallon prevented it. And somebody else says, so what if she shot one of the enemy? They were well able to do it themselves. What about the millions who died in the futile war that was going on? Somebody else, Joe, says they were very poor at the end in Lissadel and the nuns helped them out. Shane McAmosh and Anne Matthews, thank you very much indeed for joining us for our first debate on popular figures in Irish history. Are some of them overrated? What do you think? And would you like us, or who rather would you like us to discuss next? Let us know. Email history@rte.ie or text 51551. After the break, 30 years after the Kenny report.